We're really excited to have you here, Julie. Thank you so much for joining us.
As I
explained, we solicited questions from our members and we have a lot of great questions. So we're just going to dive right in.
Awesome.
Our first question is from Coben. And just as a word to our listeners, a lot of the questions for Julie had quite significant context around them. So I'll read that context and then we'll focus in on the question. So from Coben, he said, I look around and worry about the state of our kids and families, looking at the violence, anxiety, suicide, and so on with our youth. It's hard not to recognize something has gone terribly off the rails in our society. We've forgotten how to be bored, to think about hard and difficult problems, to dedicate oneself to a larger cause. So his question is, what I'm wondering is, how do you teach self-sufficiency and self-efficacy, which require trying and failing multiple times in a culture that values ease above all else?
It's interesting, Coben. I appreciate the question. I don't agree that the culture values ease above all else. I think in the leisure class, we do have ease, but also in the leisure class, we have tremendous stress and pressure to be perfect and to get the IPO and to get the Tesla, to get the house. And if you're a child, if you're a young person growing up in that context, it doesn't feel like ease at all. And so that's the reason they don't have room to be idle and be bored, as you said, and then figure their way out of boredom and create something, use that imagination. They don't have time to tinker in the garage and take something apart and put it back together or build something new, which is frankly how you develop an engineer's instinct. They don't have time for that because they're in every after school program and in every AP class and so on. And when I ask young people to be sure to make time for downtime to just think so that they can process, they're like, what are you talking about? I don't have downtime. And when I do have downtime, I feel unproductive, unsuccessful, and judged. So I don't think the culture values ease. I think the culture values a very narrow definition of achievement, mm-hmm. and self-sufficiency and self-efficacy are undermined when we, the parents, think, oh, my kid needs to get that A in that class, so I'm going to kind of help with the homework tonight, or my kid needs to get to that college, so I'm going to make sure that I'm filling out the forms. The parent living too much of the kid's life is what undermines self-efficacy and self-sufficiency. So they get sort of arrived at the outcome that society or parents deem as worthy. But if the kid hasn't done enough of the trying it, stumbling, picking themselves back up, to your point about failure, trying and failing multiple times being essential, if the kid hasn't done it, but the parent has kind of done it for them, they may get to the desired outcome without having developed the know-how and the skills such that they can replicate it once they're at this point of arrival.
Our next question is from Jasmine, who asked, how do you know when you've failed at something and what are some good ways to respond to failure?
So I'm 54 years old, which means I've had a lot of failure. And I am now in a place where I can love myself through it. Because I know I can't change the past. So there's no point in ruminating over what I shoulda, coulda, woulda done differently, if only. Where do we know failure? We know it in our bones. You feel it, your gut, your spirit, your soul, your brain, wherever you want to say that our innermost sense of, ooh, is located, it'll tell you, oh, I failed at that, right? That failure is like, damn, things didn't go my way. Oh, I wanted a different outcome. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. Feelings of shame, feelings of embarrassment, feelings of disappointment. You know, I think these are all things that we think of as evidence of, oh, I failed at that. And whether it was an actual failure F versus A is irrelevant. It's like, it didn't go as I had hoped. And your body will tell you, is my point. Good responses are, as I alluded to at the front end, developing a mindfulness practice where you can scan your feelings at all times. Like, what's going on for me? Oh, I'm feeling pretty embarrassed. Okay. Yeah. You're embarrassed. That's okay. You can't change that. What just happened? Maybe you want to say something. Maybe you don't. Julie, what do you want to do differently? What do you want to learn from this? I have this internal dialogue with myself running all the time, frankly. I can't change the past. I can be in charge of myself going forward. Learning and growing is the name of the game in this one life. So how am I going to learn from this, what just happened, so I can grow, be more effective next time? Mindfulness is really the key.
Our next question was from Penn, who says, my impression is that your latest book is kind of dealing with the fallout from helicopter or snowplow parenting. People are becoming adults who've never actually had the chance to build the skills necessary to be an adult. And so the question from him is, what are the main consequences you are seeing as a result?
So Penn, I sort of got to this with Coben's question. So this is the new book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. This is my compassionate beckoning to you, people who are struggling with adulting. Like, yep, yeah, I know it's hard. Yep, it's scary. Yep, I got you. I got you. Okay, you can do this. It's hard, but you can. And let me be alongside you as we unpack some pieces of it. That's the new book. And look, I think you're absolutely right. I'm not presuming every young adult was overparented, but definitely some were. And there are pieces of this book where I say, you know, for some of you, what's happening is a result of patterns laid down in childhood. So to the question, what are the main consequences you're seeing as a result? When people have been overparented, they often just lack the basic skills to fend for themselves. Fending is just like, take care of your body, take care of your belongings, take care of your bills, take care of your business, just the basics, just getting through a day or a week, feeling fairly confident that I've got this. You're like, not I'm amazing, but like, I can do the things necessary to keep myself going. Okay. If we've been overparented, we don't have those skills. And then what happens? Well, that can lead to anxiety. I don't know how to do things. What's wrong with me? Nothing's wrong with you. You weren't taught. You need to learn. It's okay. Yep. Right. You can't, right? Or when we've really undermined a person's sense of self by doing too much for them in childhood, that can lead to depression as well. So some of these instances of anxiety and or depression in young people have been attributed to a childhood where too much was done. It was almost like they were acted upon by well-intended parents, but they end up feeling like little lab rats. And it, you know, I just, no matter what happens, I get through the maze, but somebody pushed me through the maze.
Right.
Psychologically, the brain knows I didn't really do this myself. So we've got to get self-efficacy developed. Yes, you can. Resilience is also undermined. If a parent has always paved the way, you've never dealt with the adversities, then when a little adversity happens, you feel really ouch and stung because you haven't developed that kind of know-how, that thicker skin from, oh, the little bad things along the way make us better prepared to deal with the next bad thing. And right. So it's really agency or self-efficacy and resilience that are undermined.
Right.
Those are the main consequences.
So I put in a few questions here. We did get a lot of questions about the overparenting, so I've tried to stack them together. Jane asks, what is your perspective on how the overparenting trend began? And what are some of the ways for 20 and 30 somethings who are now becoming parents, implying that maybe they were overparented, but if they're becoming parents, how can they now raise more independent kids?
Yeah. Well, here I'm going to point to my first book, which is How to Raise an Adult. This came out 7 years ago. It's my manifesto on don't overparent. I know what I know because I was a dean at Stanford University, seeing a lot of overparented young people as deans and administrators on every campus we're seeing. This was in the early 2000s. And I'm also a mom with two 20-somethings, a mother of two 20-somethings whom I adore and whom I overparented. So I have this like, don't do it. Oh, but oh, hey, I was doing it too. Like it's everywhere. Okay. So I would say, check out my book. If you're raising kids and really want to get it right from the start, this book will walk you through how to raise kids who have agency and resilience and aren't little dogs on your leash forever. Okay. This book is that resource. But where did it start? Look, in a nutshell, it started in the mid 80s. We shifted as a society in many ways around how we interacted with children, from homework to after school activities to play, which became play dates, to the sort of safetyism, bubble wrap, everything, to ribbons and trophies all the time for anything. We just became this sort of society that was like, childhood shall be attended in the micro moment. We will always be there. We will always be rooting and cheering and so on. It became this sort of hovering parental style, mm-hmm. coined for the first time by Foster and Klein, I believe are their names, in 1990, the term helicopter parent. And the first generation or set of kids to be overparented in that way, as first labeled in 1990, they were the ones to have the first play date in 1984. And they came to college in the late 90s with parents who still wanted to micromanage everything. So this is not new. We've now had an entire generation, millennials, raised this way. And now Gen Z has been raised this way. And frankly, it's sort of a natural response to the neglect that many in Gen X, my generation, experienced. Our parents were like, whatevs, I got my friends, I got my cocktails, I'll see, you know, make, start dinner. You know, they were like, come in when the street lights come on, do anything you want after school. There was no way to track us, no way to know where we were. That was just the way things were. There was a lot of freedom in that, and we developed a lot of skills. Some of us were neglected, and that was not a good thing. And I think there's a lot of people now in my generation parenting this way, just to be the opposite of what our parents were. So we've got to go from this extreme of maybe that boomer and Gen X childhood where sometimes it was neglectful. Now we've got this overcorrection with helicopter parenting, handle everything, watch you all that. We need to find this middle place, which is my job is to put myself out of a job as a parent and raise offspring who can do things for themselves. That's right. Parental success, not getting the A tomorrow, but not getting to the A today, but parenting for tomorrow, which is I'll be dead one day. I need to have confidence my kids can do for themselves.
Question from DM who asks, do helicopter/snowplow parents act the way they do because they genuinely want to remove obstacles from their child's lives? Or is it that they know it saves them time and it's just easier to get it done than have to spend the time dealing with consequences the kid may face if they do something wrong?
I think it's both, DM. Okay. I think it's both. And I would add, there's another, so we do it because we love our kids and want the best for them. And because we tend to be almost entirely smarter, more capable, more resourced than our kids. So it's like, why wouldn't I do everything to help? Well, you've forgotten that you're supposed to teach them to do everything, right? But it's like, I want to help lovingly. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid that my kid will fail if I don't help. The world is scary. Yes. But you're supposed to teach your kid to thrive in a scary world, not pretend you'll always be there to protect your kid from a scary world.
Right.
And there's the ego, which is, I need my kid to be on that robotics team. I need my kid to be on the extra special baseball team. I need my kid to get into this school. You know, I need that as a matter of ego to impress all the people I think are judging me. And this is where the kid becomes almost like the project of the parent.
Right.
Or the pet on the leash. I joke that it's like the Westminster dog show, and we're the trainer, and we've got our fancy outfit, and the child is the dog running through the obstacle course that we've set up, or soaring through the hoops that we've set up, and we've got our special way of making sure our child, our dog, gets through it. We're going for best in breed, best in class, best in show. So everyone's like, you're amazing, because your dog child is amazing, right? There's definitely that piece of it. And I'm here for anybody who's resonating with this, like your little heart is fluttering right now, because you're like, that's me, that's me. I'm here to say that harms you. You know it.
Right.
You are not their pet or their project or the evidence of their worth or failure. Okay. Mm-hmm. You are this unique, amazing individual. And I am here for you, trying to help you figure out, how do I disentangle myself from that? You know, and I tell parents on the flip side, get a life and you're going to get one too.
Well, that leads in really great to the next question from Al, who says, if you know you have a helicopter parent who's attempting to hold your hand through every life event beyond the age of 18, how could you tell them to stop without the parents feeling critiqued or pushed away? Is there a way to create a new dynamic that still honors the wisdom the parent wishes to impart?
I get this question wherever I go. I often give assemblies to, say, seniors at a high school, and I get this question, or I speak to college students or people in their young 20s, and I get this question. And it was asked so often, and it is clearly the intersection. It's like that moment when it's like, okay, I'm not going to be on your leash forever. I want to go off leash and go live my life, but I don't want to offend you or be disrespectful. So I've actually outlined a 6-step method for this, and I'm going to breeze through it right now, but I'm also going to refer you to my brand new TED course, the TED people with TED Talks. They've just come out with a new branch of their work called TED Courses. And I am the instructor in one of these courses. It's called How to Become Your Best Adult Self.
Okay.
And one of the key things is how to have this difficult conversation. So I think the Farnham folks are going to give you the link to that. And I hope you'll check it out. But here it is condensed. Number one, you say to your folks, hey, folks, I've got something I'd like to talk with you about. Can we make time either tonight or this weekend? You're going to frighten them by saying this because they're going to be like, whoa, they want to talk. You're acting maturely, but you're also putting them on notice. I got something important to talk about. They'll be a little scared, which is fine. They'll be paying attention. Number two, you're in the meeting. Whatever time you've set, you're now having that meeting and you open with gratitude. Okay. You use the highest form of respect that your family engages in terms of language. For some, it's, I love you and I know you love me. For some, it's I respect you and appreciate everything you've provided me. Or I know you've sacrificed a ton to help me get where I've gotten and I'm grateful. Or you've instilled a lot of great values in me and I really appreciate whatever you can offer that is the highest form of praise in the language of your culture and your family, do that. They will be further afraid because they're like, what is happening? What is coming? Right? That's fine, because now you've got their full attention. Step three, you frame the thing. I'd like to talk about where I'm going to go to school. I'd like to talk about what I want to study. I'd like to talk about what I'm going to do next in my career. I'd like to talk about my dating life. I'd like to talk about my identity. Whatever it is, you frame it and say, I know you have your thoughts. So I'd actually like you to go first and just tell me your thoughts in this area. And then I'll share mine. Okay, I've lost track of my steps because I'm anyway, but let's say step four is they are saying what they think and you actively listen. So you just repeat back as kindly and as neutrally as possible. You don't use snark. You don't use anger. You're just like, so what I'm hearing you say is, and you repeat back their thoughts. You're demonstrating what active listening looks like because you're about to ask for that in return. Okay. Step five, you say what you need to say. And hopefully they will participate in the active listening and so on. Hopefully we've prepared the way for them to be thoughtful listeners. You're now in step five, really saying what you wanted to say all along and having this meeting and setting up all these steps designed for you to be successful when you actually speak your mind. And then if they don't accept where, you know, if this hasn't reached some degree of better agreement than you had before or acceptance, you say, you know, did grandparents, you know, let you do what you wanted or accept you the way you were? And the answer will either be yes or no. If it was yes, you say, that's just what I'm asking for. Mm-hmm. If it's no, you say, well, how did you feel in that moment? Mm-hmm. Because you want them to summon empathy for you going back to their own selves at a younger age. Okay. And if they still aren't there, then what you say is, you know, I know you may not understand or accept what I'm saying, but this is important to me, or I know this is my truth or whatever. And I ask that you love me anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's a big line that you're drawing. Okay. Right. You've gone through all these steps to try to have a mature conversation. And at the end, you're going to say, basically, y'all, I'm doing this. That's what all of this is, right? I'm doing, you don't have to say it that way. Right? I hope you can, you know, I hope you will love me regardless, even though you don't understand it, even though you may not accept it. You know, that's the best you can do. You can't control them. You're right. In charge of you. You conduct yourself maturely and respectfully. You speak your truth. You give them the opportunity to be in dialogue with you. And if they can't move to where you'd like them to be, that's frankly their work to do. That's their therapy to have and so on. You do you. In your turn, I have, this book is full of examples. And this is the book on which the TED course is based. There are stories at the end of each chapter of people working their adulting issues out. And often it involves tension with parents. And some of the stories result in reconciliation with parents and some result in estrangement. But either way, you hear the very confident, satisfied voice of ease of this young adult who's like, I've made my peace and I'm good. And that's where I want you to be.
Our next question is from Jennifer. So there's a lot of background in this. I'll read it and then we'll get to the question at the end. She says, I'm interested in hearing what you're discerning about students and their understanding of technology, given the outcomes you aim for, like self-efficacy. When I ran a focus group of parents at the boarding school I teach at, I asked them what they think of when they hear the phrase college readiness. Parents overwhelmingly said independent. Since the overall focus group was about cell phones, I did an unplanned follow-up question and asked them whether, on average, the way they used phones to be in touch with their kids supported the goal of college readiness. And they all kind of sheepishly looked away and said no. So Jen says, it seems to me that we all like having our phones at the ready, but the ways that which we use them by default or most often are out of alignment with what we really want, which feels harder and harder to discern. It seems like phones can create the feeling of self-efficacy and independence, but she isn't sure that's what's actually happening. So the question she has for you is, do you hear students reporting a problematic relationship with their phones or a general sense that something's wrong given their prevalence and ubiquity?
Let me respond to it this way, Jennifer. I don't hear students reporting a problematic relationship with their phones. I think that's a slightly different question, actually. In other words, am I doom scrolling? Are the algorithms sucking me in? Am I being directed down this rabbit hole that Instagram or Snapchat or Facebook or Twitter or whomever has decided like I need to go down? There is that concern, but I don't think that's really at the heart of your question. Your question is about a relationship between a parent and a young person facilitated by whatever the parent can achieve through regular texting or checking in with their kid. And I do hear a lot about that. I am dismayed by the number of high school seniors who will tell me, my parents are moving to the town I'm going to college in because they just want to be nearby. When I talk to parents, I'm like, again, get a life, back off. Your kid is not your project. Your kid is fine. You are signaling to your kid that you're worried if you feel the need to move there. Like, stop, right. Stop undermining that burgeoning self-confidence that is essential for them to move out into the world with. And so the parent behavior of the constant checking is, as Jennifer said, right? She asked the parents, you know, does the way you use your phone to be in touch with your kids support their college readiness? And the parents sort of sheepishly realized no, right? The constant checking. I'm worried. Have you done this? When are you going to do this? Text me every 30 minutes. Like, we are transferring our anxiety about safety, about their academic outcomes into our kids. So right. No wonder they're like, I'm not safe unless my parents know where I am at all times. I am against GPS tracking of teenagers and young adults. I think it's creepy as fuck. I'm sorry, but I do.
I totally agree.
It's wrong. And I think psychologists are going to tell us in a few years after they've done a longitudinal study, they're going to say, okay, look, until this software genius came up with GPS track your family, know where they are all the time. Until that, the only people whose right to privacy was given up and they were surveilled by video all the time were incarcerated people and people in psychiatric wards. Because they were considered a danger to themselves or others. So they lost their right to privacy and now they're constantly watched. Okay. That used to be the only set of people who were subjected to that. And somehow, because some software genius here in Silicon Valley, where I live, decided let's have a feature where people can see where everyone is at all times. Children are routinely, and teenagers and young adults are just routinely surveilled. I know the psychologists are going to do a longitudinal study and tell us that is fomenting anxiety to be always like, am I watched? Instead of like, I need to use good judgment. I need to figure my shit out. I need to, I'm responsible for myself, right? This false safety of, oh, my parents can see the blue dot. So they know I'm here, even though I'm not home for curfew. At least they can see where I am. No, you need to learn to honor your obligations. And there should be consequences when you don't, instead of, well, the blue dot shows that I'm at Joe's house, so my parents are fine, right? The technology, the apps, texting is amazing. I'm not anti-tech, but too often we parents are allowing the technology to step in for an actual conversation with our kids. Where are you? Why are you not home? We expected you home. or, you know, let's talk about, are you using good judgment out there? Mm-hmm. We want to build trust, and trust is not built by constant checkups with the GPS apps. And we want our child to build self-confidence. And that is undermined when we're constantly needing to check in, to nag, remind, or question.
Our next question is from Augustine, who asks, suppose you were given the opportunity to completely redesign our education system, what would be the main subjects or themes? Another way to say this is, what would be the fundamental understandings you'd want every kid to have grasped when they leave?
Augustine, I appreciate this question. It's an opportunity for me to reflect. I've never been a K-12 educator. I've never designed a curriculum for a set of young people. So this is well outside my wheelhouse, but of course I have a lot of opinions. So here's the first thing that comes to mind. Your character is everything. Your character is how people feel in your presence and what they say about you when you're not there. Okay. All of us should want humans to feel at ease around us. We should want humans to feel seen, supported, accepted, believed in around us. So working on your character, I think, is the one thing that I would say you could try to be perfect at. There is no perfect character, but right. Instead of, I need the perfect test score, forget that. Work hard, try hard, learn from your mistakes. But you really want to strive for perfection in something, create a sterling character. So I'd like to see character education, K through 12. I'd like for schools to develop rubrics. Say you've got an elementary, middle, and high school or upper school. I would hope the administration and faculty would say, how is character being taught in the younger and the middle and the older? How can we measure good character? How can we set expectations that by this age, you will be able to do such and such, you know, you will be able to demonstrate such and such. And I would add to character, the sort of skill, the efficacy skills building. So things like self-sufficiency, accountability, right? Doing more and more and more for yourself throughout your schooling, instead of being constantly rescued by parents who are, oh, you forgot your lunch, we'll bring it. Oh, you forgot your assignment, we'll bring it. That's not teaching the kid, unless it's like the big day and they'll be hosed if the parent didn't bring it, you know. In the main, we need to stop rescuing constantly, which is a function of our privilege to be able to show up at your kid's school with a forgotten whatever. That's what wealthy parents can do. So as a matter of equity, it's just wrong. So I would want this sort of efficacy building and character building added in alongside the sort of traditional academic things. And we also have to bring back civics. No one understands a damn thing about democracy anymore, and how democracy exists and how it's supported and how it's undermined, right? We all have to do our part, the importance of voting, right? That's fallen by the wayside, as have things like shop and home ec, where kids learn how to make shit and they learn how to fix shit and they learn, right? That sounds like a busy school day, I realize, but I think we've overdone it on this sort of academic enrichment at all costs. Well, the costs are now becoming evident. We've really missed out on some fundamental things kids need to learn.
Right. No, that's amazing points. You know, sometimes you read something about like the struggle for like women to get the vote, and then you see voter turnouts and it's less like it's 100 years later. And it's like, whoa, how quickly we forget, you know? Okay, our next question is from York, who says, is there a danger that with so many people struggling with anxiety and stress over daily life, that poor behaviors are reinforcing each other? Or maybe a better way to say it is, how can people get out of the feedback loops of anxiety that they see around them?
A lot of us are struggling with anxiety and stress. And what I hear psychologists who study this stuff say is, not all stress is bad. And it's okay to be anxious about something in the moment. That doesn't necessarily mean you have a chronic, always present or always lurking sense of anxiety. So I think being able to talk about our struggles and stress, I'm anxious about this, without catastrophizing, I have anxiety. Some of us do have anxiety and we need therapy and meds and support around that. But many more of us don't have full-blown anxiety. We're just anxious in the moment. So getting more savvy about understanding that, is this a thing right now that I can talk myself through what happened, what am I worried will happen? Check the facts, as a therapist would say. What do you actually know to be true and factual, as opposed to what you're worried might be?
Right.
Developing that practice within the self to kind of acknowledge stress and struggle and really then analyze it and then put it to rest, because your brain is satisfied. Okay, we dealt with that. I feel right. Good now. Keep going. So I think it can be quite healthy that we're talking about it with each other, but we don't want to, we want to always have a mindset of, you know, all right, what can I be in charge of in this moment, so that whatever feelings of stress and anxiety I'm feeling are not kind of dominating me. And
right.
If I can't get myself out of that with some dialogue with myself or with friends, talking through with somebody, then maybe that is a sign that I have the bigger full-blown thing and I need to go really talk to a professional about that.
Our next question was from JJ. What is the number one thing people can do to better cope with uncertainty?
JJ, yep, uncertainty is a fact of life. This existence, this planet is full of chaos. That's the way it is. Much of life is uncertain. I'm gonna tell you, the only thing you have control over, if you work hard at it, is yourself. You get to decide in every moment, how will I act? How will I respond? How will I speak? What will I sound like? What will my body language be? And with a mindfulness practice, you can really get to be in good charge of yourself, so that you choose in every interaction how to be. And so as I've worked on that in my late 30s, I've told you I'm 54. So for about 14, 15 years, I've been working on mindfulness. And it used to be this clunky thing, like, how do you do this? And now it's this, it's like an operating system that just runs me. It's like, okay, I'm in this, I'm uncomfortable. What am I going to do? I feel scared. What am I going to do? And what I will always come back to is, I'm only in charge of myself. So what can I do in this moment? I would like to reframe it as, I know what I can't do. The pandemic was a perfect example, telling us you can't do this. You can't be here. Don't do that. Fine. But I can reframe it as, I can't do all those things. What can I do? Here's an example. Early in the pandemic, winter solstice, 2020, kids are home, you know, they're like 18 and 20 at the time, and just, you know, losing their right pandemic mindset for young people. And I'm like, shit, you know, my family's really struggling. We can't do a damn thing. We can't have people over. What can we do? I can rouse them out of bed with a little warning early in the morning to go climb a small hill and watch the sunrise on the winter solstice, which is the shortest day of sunlight. And let that be some kind of free offering that, look, we can watch the sun come up together. We can say this heralds the beginning of longer days. Like, I designed a little event for my family as a way to cope with the uncertainty, gathering with humans we love, maybe having a beverage or a snack, going on a bit of an outdoor adventure, right? These are tremendous ways to say the sun still comes up. I'm still here. I still rise. Having a project or a purpose that matters to you is how people get really pulled through the darkest times of life. And these are not the darkest times. Our ancestors, quite likely your ancestors, went through worse.
Yeah. So
summon that memory. How did my ancestors survive the Holocaust? How did my ancestors, you know, survive slavery? How did my ancestors survive whatever torment their group went through, right? Summon that memory. Know that you're descended from people who went through some shit, right? Let them inspire you. So these are just some examples of how to cope. But fundamentally, it's like, you're in charge of you. So keep that self as healthy and well and functioning as you can, and then do the things that give you a sense of purpose and meaning.
Next question is from Jeff. He asks, or he says, before COVID, I found socializing and small talk came easy. Now I struggle to even stand close to colleagues in the office. Do you have any recommendations on how I can ease myself back into my pre-COVID self?
Beautiful reflection. Just telling it to yourself is progress, because you're taking that sort of lurking fear or anxiety, that feeling of worry, like, and you're naming it, which helps tame it. Name it to tame it. Okay, so step one, you've done and shared it in public. Step two, wonderful. I would say what do you miss? Colleagues being in the office? I would say, like, can we gather? Can we do more outside things? Can we go to that cafe that's outdoors? Can we go on a walk together? Human interaction is essential for your wellness. So we need each other, which is why the pandemic has been so awful. So it's like, how can you adapt and do that in new ways that address the safety issues that are still present with COVID, you know, give you the degree of comfort you need, but you're still interacting with humans?
A similar type personal question is from Guijo, who the background is, I am 34 years old, have a successful job and married to a wonderful woman, have a great relationship with my family and an excellent group of friends. I have read self-help books and listened to podcasts to always become a better version of myself. I work on my mental, emotional, and physical health constantly. But there are times when I abandon my routine, which I consciously know is good for me, and find myself falling into the same negative spiral that is led by alcohol. It happens about once a month. I do therapy and talk about this constantly. I know I am not alone in this, and I have difficulty understanding if it is an escape from the stress of my job or something else. So my question is, what would you say to someone like me to help me better manage this relationship with alcohol?
So Guijo, I want to first applaud your bravery in talking about this to yourself, with me, and sharing this with all of us. It's, again, to name it is to tame it. So just being very conscious that this is your practice, that about once a month, it sounds like you have this negative spiral led by alcohol. I feel for you. My heart is with you. There's nothing wrong with alcohol implicitly, but it's something we can get addicted to. I'm not clear where you are or what your degree of concern is about. Is this, and you know, it sounds like you're concerned enough. I don't know if you would call it an addiction. If you're only doing it once a month, probably not, but still it may sound like you're doing so much to keep yourself healthy and well, and you're eating right and reading self-help books and doing all of these things. And once a month you're like, fuck it, I need some booze. And so maybe there's sort of a strenuousness about your routine and it's a bit much. It may be that if you're like, you know what, I need a little bit of ease 29 days out of the month so that day 30 isn't the day I say to hell with it. I'm going to be led by alcohol to places I don't want to go. That's one thought. I'm going to stop there because frankly, I'm not your therapist. I'm glad you have a therapist. This isn't my wheelhouse. I haven't personally struggled with this. I guess I will add, for me, it's around managing my prediabetes and, you know, my health issue is that. And so I just eat the same thing every day. That's the right number of this and that in order to deal with my prediabetes. But then sometimes I'm like, what the heck, man, I can't have, you know, I have to figure out the balance. So I just got to a certain metric I was aiming for. And I was like, today I'm having pizza to celebrate how hard I've worked. And then I know this will have consequences for a couple of days. And I had to have that. And I think that's maybe similar to the alcohol once a month thing. You know, there's a scarcity or deprivation that's happening in the 29 out of the 30 days. And if we could bring a little less deprivation and scarcity or intensity to those 29 days, maybe day 30 won't be a blowout.
Mm, yeah, really good insight. Our next question is from Abhishek, and the question is how to fight better. The context is about the things you care about. He says, with my partner, my wife mostly, it's a relationship I care about immensely, and it's the only relationship where I want to actively address or confront disagreements because I feel just letting go or pushing things under the rug will ruin this beautiful thing. And I feel preserving honesty is an important factor. But oftentimes when we confront each other, we end up in shouting matches. We both love each other and would like better tools to navigate through disagreements.
Abhishek, again, I'm not a relationship therapist or anything. I do recommend you get one, but I'll tell you what I've done. I'm in a 34-year relationship with my boyfriend. Okay. I met him when he was 19, I was 20, and now he's 53 and I'm 54. And we got married 30 years ago this summer. And, we've had our share of fights, of course, when we've had moments of great or years of great joy and then years of like, oh my God. And that was when kids came. We're like, oh my God, like, you know, ships passing in the night, little snippy arguments. And we're in a place now of just, man, things have never been better and things were great. So now we're like here, but took a lot of work. And I think the work is less about the fighting and more about the noticing. Let me put it this way. Let me finish my sentence and then put it this way. It's more about noticing the person and developing a gratitude practice. That, I promise you, will make your fights easier. And let me reframe it as, in the workplace, we know when we're trying to give an employee feedback, they need to hear 5 positive things to be able to handle the 1 critical thing. So that's what the research shows, I believe, 5 to 1. So if now you're in your primary relationship with your partner, they need to hear 5 positive things. And so do you, to be able to deal with the negative thing. All right. So this is what my partner, Dan, and I do. We have a gratitude practice where we have this little framed statement in our bathroom. It's a little frame you could buy at the drugstore. Behind it is a statement that said, that's typed out. It says, "I love you because : and then there's a line printed. You put that behind glass, put it in your bathroom, have a dry erase pen. You fill in the line. Okay. We have exchanged this thing. This is a way of expressing gratitude to your partner, noticing, "I see you." We must have exchanged this thing 2,000 times by now. Okay. He'll write something a few days later. I'll write something a few weeks later. He'll say something. Like, it doesn't have to be every day. Okay. When you feel it, but you get better at knowing, I need to say something. It could be like, "I love you because," you might say, "you snaked the shower drain. You stopped at the grocery store on the way home. You were so kind to my mother last night," or "you look damn good in those jeans," right? Or, "I love you because you came home. And when we've had a fight and somebody storms out and you start to resolve it, you know, I know I've written that you came back," because, right? That's a way to shore up the relationship so that fights are better. In terms of how to actually fight better, it's active listening. Not getting, you know, not being so sure that you're right, that you just have to impress upon them how dumb they are, stupid or wrong, right? That's not love, right? Love is listening. Love is allowing room for the other person to be smarter than you, more correct than you. And forget all that. Love is allowing room for the other person to have needs too, that are just as valid as yours. Mm-hmm. And getting into a dialogue space where you're like, "Look, let's talk about what's going on. I want to say what I think. I want to hear what you think. I want us to better understand each other. You are having a misunderstanding and somebody's not feeling valued somewhere. Somebody's feeling overlooked." So the gratitude practice will help you minimize the degree to which either of you is feeling overlooked, and then being in dialogue in the actual fight where you're really making room for each other to be listened to in that active listening way I was trying to model in the answer to the question much earlier about how do I talk to my parents about, you know, something that we disagree about. Active listening is key, and your therapist will teach you that. And it can feel a little clunky at first, but it's a super valuable tool.
That's amazing. I'm going to go and get those frames this weekend. That sounds really wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our next question is from Dana. What common themes surprised you across the successful people you've met and written about?
Ah, Dana, what a beautiful question. Really allows me to reflect. So let me say that this book, that's for young adults struggling with adulting or anyone trying to retool their adult life, I've got lists of things to do. I've got my own narrative, memoir, if you will, of things I've learned the hard way. But then, like I said, every chapter ends with stories of other humans. So there are close to 36 other people in here from all walks of life. And I went and found people from all walks of life to make sure my book was deeply inclusive in almost every way we think about measuring humans. And also to demonstrate, look at our differences, but also look how similar we are. And I guess the theme that surprised me is, one theme is, a lot of people had a catalyzing moment at age 14.
Really?
I was sitting on my roof at age 14. Like, what? What? Like, I really came to my sense of my identity. I was 14. There was this theme of like 14-year-old. There's something about 14-year-olds. It must be self-aware enough, optimistic enough about, you know, what the world should be. Anyway, so that was truly a surprise. But I think the biggest abiding theme for us all is, when people get right with themselves, I know who I am. I like that person. Mm. I accept myself and the identities I carry. I know what I'm good at, the skills, the ways of inquiry, the ways of being in terms of work. I know what I'm good at. And I'm living a life where I'm sort of intersecting what I'm good at with what I love, the things that matter to me topically, right? And mm-hmm. I'm choosing to be in communities, whether neighborhood, school, work, relationship, with people who love me as I am, accept me as I am. That Venn diagram, what I'm good at, what I love, and I'm where I belong. That's where I find successful people.
We just have a couple more questions. And so we'll go to Ken. What is something you feel you wasted time on when you were younger?
Pleasing other people. And I'm a people pleaser. Maybe it goes with my gender. Maybe it goes with being a Black and biracial kid who had some microaggressions and racism directed at me in my young life and in my young adult life. And so I was for decades trying to not be called the N-word. And that made me placate and supplicate, like, how can I just, you know, not be the stereotype you disdain, right? So I was in this people-pleasing mode, which really became why I chose to do certain things in my life. And I'm now doing the things I want to do because I want to do them.
Right.
I've developed the confidence that I know who I am. I know what I want. I don't ignore what other people want. I don't think I'm obnoxious or narcissistic or like whatever. I care a lot about people. I care for people. I care about people, but I am not looking for people to validate me anymore. Woo! So I can go back and tell my younger self, like, girl, it's coming. Just stop. Yeah. And I think, frankly, that's age and stage. It takes us a while
for sure
to get there. Yeah.
For sure. From Tanya, she says, I've been thinking about making a career change lately. Given your jump from dean at Stanford to author, what are considerations that most people miss but that are critical for success?
Tanya, thank you for that. And I would add, I was a lawyer before being a dean. So I have a third career. And critical considerations, you will be scared. Just accept that. Where you are, however imperfect, problematic, whatever, like, all right, at least I'm there, right? I get a paycheck. I know it, right? The devil you know is better than the devil you don't. If you're going to leap, it's terrifying. You know, many of us don't want to leap because we want there to just be certainty. Like, I'm going to leave this and do that. Well, you need to take some risks to get that next thing, particularly if it's a big shift, right? Informational interviews, test drive a job somehow, you know, try it out, volunteer, be on a board. You know, these are ways to sort of begin moving, but at some point you may need to take that job, not knowing, is this going to be better? You got to take a leap. I think it's Mike Lewis who wrote the book, When to Leap, or something like that. And he really features, I'm looking at my bookshelf here, which is, anyway, you know, it's, I guess my point, it is scary. Mm-hmm. It is scary, but it's also exhilarating when the mind and body is saying, like, you know, I really have always, when your interior voice, when you say this, what would I do if it was just up to me? And an answer comes, how long are you going to deny that answer, right? How long are you going to wait for that answer to stop coming, right? It's not going to stop. I always wanted to then do it. You know, I realize it's a privileged thing, like, just say, go do it. I realize there are risks and consequences, but heeding the call of your own soul is worth it.
That's amazing. Yeah. Okay, Julie, we have the two questions we have left. I feel you've really covered there with respect to, you know, the parenting, and you gave the 6-step process already. So we'll just cut right to the final two things about you in particular. Okay. So thank you so much, Julie, for being with us today. Are there any upcoming projects you'd like to share?
Oh, absolutely. My TED course is something I'm quite, you know, happy with. It's an asynchronous online course. You sign up, it's 4 weeks. You log in when you feel like it, but you're part of a cohort that's all going through week 1, 2, 3, and 4 together.
Okay.
So you can find that at courses.ted.com. I'm one of 6 course instructors. So you can find my course. There are 5 other great courses. I blog weekly at Julie's Pod. So Google Julie's Pod. That's my weekly short form memoir style writing, where I'm just observing stuff of life, the shit of life, like what's happened. My post today is about how my health insurance company is really not providing coverage and what the heck is wrong with that. And so I try to write very relatable things. I definitely interact with people who follow me. my website is julielifcotthames.com. So yeah, check it out. I'm also running for city council in my town as a way to deal with the uncertainty to that earlier question from JJ. The way I'm dealing with the uncertainty that America has made me feel, where I wanted to pack up and leave and I'm Googling, how do I get a Canadian passport? Like, you know what? If the privileged people leave, what does that do? It just protects me and my descendants. Fine. I'm more than that. I want to be of use. I want to help. So I've decided, man, we have some local problems here in Palo Alto. I'm going to try to deal with the uncertainty by trying to step up and be a thoughtful leader of my own city.
That's amazing. You know, so Vicky and I are both in Canada, and we did see
from your voices.
Okay. And we did see this huge surge in Google searches, how to move to Canada after some of the recent events in the States. But I feel the same way as you. Like, if the good people go, you know, you got to stay and fight, right? Canada's not perfect either. And we need to make changes here. So that's really amazing. So, and finally, what is the one book aside from your own that you find yourself recommending most often?
I meant to like find it on the shelf. First of all, the answer, you can't ask an author, what's the one book?
I know.
It's like asking someone with 12 kids, which is your favorite kid. So, you know, there isn't one, but I would say, Michael Bengay-Stanger, who I think is a part of Stanier, who's part of the Farnham Street community, has an amazing new book out called How to Begin, which is beautifully graphically designed to be about, to be a response to some of these questions we've gotten about, like Tanya's question, how do you make the leap? You know, some of these other questions. So his book, How to Begin, I wanted to hold it up, but I don't have it handy. But, you know, my favorite novel right now is Maggie O'Farrell's Hamnet, and which is the most exquisitely crafted novel about the 16th century you could ever hope to read. It's just like so gripping. So I'm always there for good writing, good story. As you can see, I'm surrounded by books. This is my outdoor she shed. I must have 2,000 books in here organized by genre. And at any given time, I've got books to recommend. So check out Michael Bengay-Stanier. And I guess actually for those of you with kids, What Can I Say by Catherine Newman. It's a graphic self-help book for kids with wonderful cartoony graphic storytelling about, like, how do you talk to people? How do you apologize? How do you say you like somebody? How do you say you don't want to be in a relationship with somebody? And this is pitched at, I think, maybe 8 to 12 or 8 to 14. I'm not sure, but it's terrific.